Last week, I think it was last week, I brought up the subject of the desert. And those of you who were here heard that talk. It was last week?
Yeah.
And we talked about various figures in history who had wandered in the desert. We talked about Jesus wandering for 40 days and 40 nights, they say. Until his the great question of life and death, the great matter for him, was resolved inside of himself, and he came to understand it, what his life was, is what we're told. And I thought about that some more, and we tend to have a lot of questions, and then we come up with answers, and we don't necessarily really know how that works exactly. Why do we know something today that we didn't know yesterday? And as I understand it, we focus on the answer, but actually the question is what brings us, of course. And it's the answer that causes the question. The answer knows we're ready to hear it. And so it says, okay, now I can ask. And so the answer poses the question. And then we work hard. And then we get to the answer. It's like our Buddha nature calling us home. At some point in our lives, usually because of circumstances, we begin to practice. And this is the answer, saying, okay, now they're ready to practice for today or for this life so that they can come home to themselves. Usually it's through some kind of suffering that this happens, where we suddenly get serious and recognize that the great matter of birth and death is filled with joy and fun, but it's not a laughing matter. It's a serious matter. It is the matter of life itself. And we talked a little bit about Moses wandering in the desert, they say, for 40 years or something like that. Seems like a long time to do that. And then eventually some way was found to the promised land. And I think I mentioned that from a Zen perspective, the desert is the promised land. That it's not that you wander in the desert and then you go someplace else. You actually find yourself through the kind of wandering that we do. Because for us, our practice of Zazen is the desert. This is where we face all the seeming loss that takes place. This is where we die of thirst. This is where we die of the heat. This is where we die of one ego loss after another. This is the place where we're stripped down to our flesh, skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, and beyond, until we find what we are. And it takes place in Zazen, through our rigorous and continuous practice, which is why continually practicing is so important. Otherwise, we're just hot, or we're just tired, or we're just stripped down. What's the point of that? There's no point. So I was thinking about the Sangha, and you know, I've been doing a Dokusan with you people for a long, long time. Many, many years. And so there isn't anybody who I've had the opportunity to talk with who has not suffered loss in that time. Sometimes we talk about a little loss, sometimes we talk about a big loss, but there's always some kind of loss involved. So it made me think, I think I'd like to read this, you know, not the whole thing, but excerpts from this chapter, from my teacher's teaching. It's in the book No Beginning, No End, Jaksho Kongrachi. And in the late 1990s, he asked me if I would take his teachings and make a book out of it, make his Dharma book. And it was quite a task. There's a lot of loss involved. I was handed 50 or 80 or 100 tapes and 1,600 single-spaced pages of text, and asked to come up with a 200-page Dharma book, which could really make you lose your mind or find your mind. So it's quite wonderful. And one of the talks that I remembered liking very much, and I was at this talk, was called Active Participation in Loss. So I wanted to bring that in now. We should know that from the teachings in the Buddha Dharma, and if you think about the Heart Sutra that we chant every day or a week, depending on what your practice is, no increase, no decrease. Yet our life seems to be filled with increase and decrease. So what could it be talking about? No gain, no loss. No birth, no death. No rising, no perishing. Doesn't make any sense if we just look at it with our ordinary perspective. So Roshi has a different perspective, which is a very classic, traditional understanding. And I thought it would be some fertile ground for us in this desert. We should sit in. It would help us sit in the fertility of the desert. So I'll read a lot of this chapter, but not entirely. Accepting things as they are is a loss. Being in the moment is a loss. We are losing every moment of our lives. What are we losing? We are losing our self-centeredness, our self-clinging, our ideas, our condition. That's a little epigraph at the top. In the late Uchiyama Roshi's book, Opening the Hand of Thought, he uses a phrase that made a very deep impression on me because it points to something that's been part of my life for a long time. The phrase is active participation in loss. Usually we want to avoid loss at all costs. We're conditioned to seek only gain, to be happy, and to try to satisfy all of our desires. Even though we understand intellectually that loss is the very mud in our lives that the lotus needs in order to bloom, when it comes to our actual lives, most people still believe loss is the opposite of gain. We are actively participating in loss. Actively means that we are willing, committed, not giving up, and that we have the courage to die while being alive. The word loss refers to death and all the things we usually don't want to talk about. It also implies failure and impermanence. It's about suffering, fear, surrender, and letting go. All those things we believe to be negative, despite the fact that they actually serve as the impetus for most of us to practice. Loss in life brings us to practice. Impermanence brings us to practice. These are the perfect antidotes to a self-centered, gaining life. In fact, if we could have a very permanent or secure, guaranteed life, if that were at all possible, most people would not practice because they would feel no need. When I began to practice Zen in 1960, there was a lot of interest in the martial arts, kendo, and swordsmanship. I should tell you, so Kwang Roshi was one of Suzuki Roshi's first students right after Suzuki Roshi came to the United States from Japan. I remember reading about some techniques in swordsmanship, and in one book it said the best way in combat is to come out, strike your opponent, and quickly get away. In other words, no complicated technique. I thought it sounded like Zen, very simple and direct, and very difficult to do without practice. But the most difficult part for me came when the book confirmed the fact that the combat was to end in a mutual slaying. I didn't like that because I wanted to win. I didn't want to be slain. I wanted to have the gain of winning the contest and ending up alive. But every day within our lives, to know how to lose is to be alive. Accepting things as they are is a loss. being in the moment is a loss. We are losing every moment of our lives. What are we losing? We are losing our self-centeredness, our self-clinging, our ideas, our conditioning. We are also losing ourselves to the sound of the crickets, to the sound and feeling of the zendo as we sit day after day, night after night. And when we know how to do this, to really lose, then we know how to really be alive. We generally say that to have a good seat takes 10 years. When you think about how long it takes a fruit tree to bloom and bear fruit, 10 years is not a very long time. But we shouldn't just understand this literally. 10 years could be striking my stick on the floor, or it could actually be 10 years. But generally, it does take us some time to cultivate this seat. As I mentioned, Sekito Kisen, the Stonehead Zen master who wrote Sendokai that we chant every week, used to sit on a very large stone. On this stone was carved the Chinese characters that read Genso, meaning source of our ancestors. How do you understand this phrase? Of course, Sekito Kisen is our ancestor. But at the same time, the ancestor and the source of the ancestor is none other than the source of our own mind source. Do you understand? We are the same as the undying person in the hermitage. That's our source, our most intimate self, appearing in one unbroken moment, preciously, pervasively, quiet, calm, and forever bright. Do you know what you're doing when you are practicing? When this ancestor, your most intimate self, is practicing, you are practicing active participation in loss. We have fear, denial, resistance, sleepiness, exhaustion, and pain. We have the whole spectrum of loss. There's no gain here. Suzuki Roshi used to mention gaining self. In this kind of situation, there's not much gain because you are participating with loss. That means that even though you are sitting quietly on the cushion, you are actively, energetically participating with the many things. You are actively participating with pain changing to sensation, with noise changing to sound, with the awareness of distraction or sleepiness, on and on. Because you can practice being with these things, little by little, you will not be bothered by these conditions. Awareness vanishes delusion. Even the sound of crickets will harmonize with your mind. When you practice active participation in loss, you are reconditioning yourself to re-enter the unconditional world. This is a very important statement. When you practice active participation in loss, you are reconditioning yourself. It's like you're resetting the computer. You're rebooting with a new program. Not the one that is the one we inherited and the culture gives us and that our ego gives us and our personality gives us and our school and everything and our parents want for us to have. We are reconditioning yourself to re-enter the unconditional world, to become one with all things. Not the separate self that we're conditioned to remain and that fights against loss. Actually, this phrase comes from the realized saying by Uchiyama Roshi's teacher, Kotosawaki Roshi, who said, gain is delusion, loss is enlightenment. In our contemporary language, we say, loss is where it's at. The first noble truth that Buddha realized is that life is suffering. Maybe like some of you, when I first heard this a long time ago, I felt it had a negative connotation. But it's about actively participating with suffering, actively accepting the inevitability of change, which is an undeniable condition of our lives. Things are neither fixed nor permanent, but are constantly changing from moment to moment. There's an old saying, you cannot step into the river in the same place twice. We usually create our own universe. We believe that we can step into the same place twice because we try to solidify our changing world so that our conditioned self can feel a sense of security. Isn't that true? We try to make everything seem solid because we are so scared of the inevitable truth of impermanence. One of the things that I have to interject at this point is to say that Zen doesn't turn away from this essential fact of impermanence. It is a deep truth. And as long as we keep trying to turn away from the deep truth of change, and the deep, which people consider loss, from the deep truth of impermanence, from the deep truth that nothing can ever be what it is, what we think it was just a second ago, we are turning our back on reality and we are embracing delusion. Our Zen practice forces us again and again and again to stay exactly where things are in that moment, knowing that in the next moment, it's gone. Our mind is different. Our bodies are different. Our feelings are different. Our thoughts are different. Our perceptions are different. And the whole world is different. And yet we try to keep things from happening. And we call that fighting for life. And one of the things Kwan Roshi is saying is we're actually fighting against life. We're fighting against the truth of life. Things are neither fixed nor permanent, but are constantly changing from moment to moment. There is an old saying, you cannot step into the river in the same place twice. We usually create our own universe. We believe that we can step into the same place twice because we try to solidify our changing world so that our conditioned self can feel a sense of security. But actually, the whole river is moving, and the entire environment, both river and shore, is changing as well. It's only the fabrication of our minds that we are actually stepping into the same spot twice. But the truth of the impermanence is stronger than our mind fabrications can ever be. And as a result, there is plenty of suffering or loss that will appear when we ignore this clear fact. A few years ago, we received a wonderful gift at the temple. It was an 11-faced wooden sculpture of Kannon Bosatsu, of Kanzeon. And I have to tell you, it's 14 feet high. And they drove it from Arizona to our temple. Can you imagine Kannon driving down the freeway? It was an 11-faced wooden sculpture of Kannon Bosatsu. She is the mother of all Buddhas because of her great mercy and compassion. One of the most distinguishing features of this 11-faced Kannon is the crown that adorns her head. The main face that you see represents our regular face. Just as when we look in the mirror, it's our face, and at the same time, it's not our true face. This is very much like Tozan Rinpoche's enlightenment poem, which I've talked about at Sesshin. While crossing a stream, Tozan Rinpoche experienced his true reflection in the water, and in that moment, he realized that he was not just an object to be seen. On Kannon's crown, the first three faces are similar, calm in appearance, and very peaceful. So here's the front, and then going this way. The first three, calm, very peaceful. As you move sunwise from right to left around the crown, the faces become more and more ghastly, reflecting our agonizing states of suffering, fear, anger, and hopelessness. We might ask, why does the Bodhisattva of compassion have that as her crown? Why would the Bodhisattva of compassion have faces that show suffering, fear, anger, and hopelessness? I find this interesting, says Kwan Roshi. It would be difficult for the first three faces on the statue to see the ones on the sides, and even more difficult for them to see the ones in the back, just as it's difficult for us to see or really to face these things within ourselves. Isn't that great? Really difficult for us to see or face the suffering and the fear and the anger and the hopelessness in ourselves. But if you wear them as a crown, all the faces become Buddha. We could say that the fourth face represents anger and hate. With real practice, when you are actively participating in the loss that these conditions demand, your posture, your breath, and your awareness will gradually dissolve the solidity of these delusional phases, because in the end, they are transparent and there is nothing behind them. We say, because you are not aware, it's not practiced. And if it's not practiced, it isn't perfected. And if it's not perfected, this fact cannot be realized. The fifth face expresses anxiety, frustration, and confusion. The sixth, you could say, is isolation and rejection. We were all getting so depressed. The seventh, eighth, and ninth faces represent the most difficult situations we will inevitably face in our lives: devastation, despair, and hopelessness. This does not seem to be good news. But because we are fortunate enough to have a Dharma practice, we aren't forced to drink or take drugs or commit suicide when we meet these faces. Kanon wears all of these faces on her crown because they are a fact of living. So the Bodhisattva does not turn away from any face. And that is her crown. That is our crown. We don't turn away. The truth is that as you go around Kanon's crown, you're actually getting closer to something wonderful. Even though your energy may be low and you may not feel well, sometimes in these last phases, you look surprisingly good because something is really happening. Finally, you arrive at hopelessness. You thought I was going to say something else, didn't you? This is probably the worst one. This is the bottom. But even though there's no more hope, again, there's no need to harm yourself. Despite your feeling as if there's no ground beneath you and no choice in any direction. The fact that you have no choice can be a good thing, because you definitely know which way to go in the midst of this hopelessness. Actually, the last face to appear is the Buddha, right in the heart of hopelessness. We know that this is the path, and we resolve to stay with it. In Zen, there are no promises made, but we know that this is the practice too. This is how faith and vow are born in Zen practice. Needless to say, we develop deep faith through our own experience of physical and mental loss. It's an important sentence. Needless to say, we develop deep faith through our own experience of physical and mental loss. There's a story that is very relevant when we find ourselves in this condition. One day a monk was walking through the mountain near some cliffs when suddenly she felt the ground slip from beneath her feet. She experienced herself falling, and at the last moment as she fell, she grabbed onto a branch that was sticking out from the side of the cliff. Frightened, she called out, "Help! Help!" But no one was around to hear her. After some time, a teacher and some students who were walking nearby heard her cries and came to the edge of the cliff. When the monk saw them, she shouted, "Please, you've got to help me." The teacher looked at the situation and said to her, "Just let go." Isn't that wonderful? Just let go. The monk was terrified because she knew she was hanging vertically in midair, high above the ground, and yet here's this teacher telling her to let go. "I can't," she cried. But the teacher was very firm and clear and told her, "You've got to let go. Without any hesitation, you've got to let go now." So she did. The monk let go and found that she had not been hanging vertically in midair after all. The entire time, she had been lying horizontally on the ground, and the ground had been supporting her all along. Try to think about a time that you felt that you had gone off the cliff or over the cliff and were hanging vertically in midair, afraid to let go, clinging for your life, and how many times you found that actually something had been supporting you all along, something that we may not even be able to name. But certainly, Roshi in this part is also referring to our practice, and especially to our Buddha nature. Something that we can't abandon, and that can't abandon us. We have so much confusion, so much delusion. Our egos have convinced us through our own thoughts that we are hanging vertically and that we're sure to fall straight down into the darkness. But when we do let go, how wonderful. We discover that the darkness is actually full of light. Now we can take a very deep rest, filled with the warmth of relief and complete satisfaction. When I was in the Southwest recently, the vast landscapes were covered with snow. Although I felt a kind of cold desolation in this environment, I could still see a tip of early spring emerging from within the snow. In southern Colorado, I was within the range of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, Blood of Christ Mountains. The valley there is three times the size of Connecticut, and the mountains are 14,000 feet high and very sharp. My feeling was, these are real mountains. Among them was a mountain called Greenhorn, which was rounder and softer than the others, yet it had a very impressive presence. The people I was with told me that this mountain had been under the ocean three times. Isn't that a long time? The sharp and angular ones were the young mountains. And it's perfect that this is so. In the process of active participation in loss, we are worn down by space and time. We are worn down by wind and rain and sun. We are even worn down by the moon and the stars. We are just like Greenhorn Mountain. But by actively participating in the wonder of real practice, we realize there is no choice. This realization is a very important one for you to make. Because you know this, you will stay on the path. In truth, there is no place to go. With the help of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you will go through, through, and through, and you will realize what has always been here and what has always been with you. This active participation in loss is our great gift. I'd like to close with a poem I wrote. I don't write poetry often, but my hope is that I might share with you the precious gift of loss. Night dies into day. Day dies into night. Exhaling is intimate with loss. Inhaling, I am renewed. So. Thank you, Roshi. What time is it, by the way?
8:21.
Great, okay. One of the... did you enjoy some of that? I hope so. Even though we know the truth of impermanence, as I was saying, we fight it. We believe that if we just stand strong enough, we can stop the river from flowing. But if you have spent any time with rivers and stones, you see that the river wears the stone down. The stone will change. It will soften. It will change shape. And eventually, it may even disappear. But the river will continue to flow. Even though we know this, we determine to stand like a stone. Not flowing with the truth of impermanence, but standing against it. And it causes enormous suffering of a particular kind. I think there's a difference in suffering because of the truth of things and suffering because of delusion. This is why I'm saying this to you. Of course, I don't want anything terrible to happen to you or to anyone else that I love. But denial will not accomplish that. So when we face our lives as they are, in the world as it is, we can't turn our back on what's true. The Buddha's understanding of the nature of reality is based on the truth of impermanence. This is just a fact. If there is such a thing as a fact, that's it. And so our practice asks us to confront that again and again and again. When we sit zazen and we get lost in our various mind trips and delusions, our practice says, come back. And so we practice not being lost in delusion. That's what's going on. We lose delusion to gain an experience of presence of our true self, instead of losing our true self to solidify the mind states that delusion brings. If someone is dying, we can say, I don't want them to die, and don't die, and we can say it as much as we want. And it's okay to feel it, but to expect that that's going to change it is to create enormous extra suffering. It's okay to suffer because someone is dying. The other thing is just extra. And it keeps us from touching what we really are. So this is an important thing to know. Many times you may, well, maybe you experience it and in one form or another. But it's been written about too. Many times a Zen practitioner will be concentrating well and deeply, sitting in samadhi, sitting in that very deep, spacious, a wonderful place, place beyond thinking, almost dropping completely away, and then at the last second, they get pulled back by fear, by anxiety, that they will lose their separate seeming self if they realize the wholeness of who they are. This is not true. You don't lose that. You simply understand what it is. You lose your delusion about it. It's very important for all of us to know this. We could waste 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50, 100 years on this cushion by continually nourishing separation from our wholeness by allowing ourselves to just kind of fly away and not doing the very simple thing of coming back and staying there. Why do we do this? I think Roshi says it very clearly. We do it because of our conditioning. We don't have to allow that conditioning to run our lives. We can see through it, just like he was saying. We can see through fear and anxiety and all delusions because they are transparent and there is no reality behind them. None. We just make it up. It's like if you know someone who is a sort of compulsive liar. You know that there's nothing behind anything they say. A lot of the mind states that we create for ourselves are just like that. I don't want to call ourselves liars, but deluded is good enough. But we all do it, don't we? We believe it. There's nothing true about it. When we actively participate in loss, when we accept change, when we accept loss, when we willfully and willingly give up all of those delusions that we've used like crutches to prop ourselves up. All of the seeming power of stopping life from being what it really is. There's a great joy that comes into us because we're finally in sync with the world as it really is. Finally in sync. We finally know what trees know, rivers know, stones know. We're the last to know. We are the last to know. So I'd like to ask you to think about how do you deal with loss? I mean, we're at different ages, but we're getting older together. We're getting older all at the same rate, pretty much. You know, some of us are in our 70s, some of us are in our 40s or 50s or 30s or whatever we are. We're all aging at exactly the same rate. It's amazing. There's a wonderful a friend of mine named Naomi Newman. She's a terrific writer and actor. And she once played a character, a homeless woman. What people called before homeless? A bag lady? Isn't that wild? You look at a woman and say she's a bag lady. What about the rest of her? She's carrying a bag, you know? And that suddenly that's her identity. If she wore pink shoes, would anyone say, oh, that she's a pink shoe lady? And think that's who she was? So ridiculous. But anyway, Naomi had this wonderful one-woman show, and in it she said, I'll imitate her a little bit. She says, people, they see me on the street, and one day somebody came up to me, some young guy, and he says, hey you, how does that feel to be getting old? And I said, what are you asking me for? You're getting old just as fast as I am. Think about it. Naomi's 85 now. And she's still performing. You know what I've really been talking about is our stickiness. The Velcro factor. Of these identities that we have. We have to really be willing to let it go. It's painful, but only because we don't want to let it go. It's disturbing, but only because we don't want to let it go. Because we fear there's nothing there. Isn't that wild? The delusions tell us there's nothing there but the delusions. And the Buddha says, you are everything. And the delusions are keeping you from knowing what that everything really is. Well, think about yourself in loss. Do we really have to hold on so tight? Just how much suffering are we creating with that simple conditioned mechanism? They say that when Jesus was in the desert, everything was stripped away until this question was resolved. Thomas Merton talks about prayer as being in the desert, and that true prayer is when everything, all of our structures, have been stripped away, and we're finally able to stand as the naked beings that we are, quote, before God, which means we finally can meet oneness as oneness itself. Buddha Dharma says the same thing. I think it's good to ask ourselves what we're so scared of. what will we lose? Yeah, Judith.
One of the things that I think I've been experiencing around both of my parents have died in the last 4 years. My husband is now dying, and I'm going to lose my home, in a sense. There's been this kind of I would have described it, I think, as overwhelming sense of loss. And one of the things that's been so interesting about it is that there is that fighting against it, as though it's a bad thing or something, or avoid is too painful, I can't go there. Somehow there's something I can do to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you ultimately find there is absolutely nothing you can do to stop it, and you stop doing all those crazy things you're trying to do and surrender to the loss, the meeting or the embracing of the loss brings with it an enormous experience of a kind of an amazing beauty,
mm-hmm.
and freedom, and a kind of joy, the awareness that joy doesn't mean the absence of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's an amazingly awful, full of awe kind of experience. And then the really, really interesting thing about that to me is you experience that and you know it, and it's just, oh. But then the next time the loss of another sort comes around, rather than, oh, I can embrace that because I know in the middle of it, I still go back to the
mm-hmm.
resistance. It's mm-hmm. it's really...
It's the conditioned self.
It is. It's so interesting to see. You think, okay, wow, I got there. Now I understand loss. So now, you know, boy, I can embrace, but no, mm-hmm. the other stuff is still
mm-hmm.
where I will automatically go first.
Mm-hmm.
But now I have a quicker awareness
mm-hmm.
that that's what I'm doing, and I can soften that
mm-hmm.
kind of grasping onto it maybe a
mm-hmm.
little sooner and give it more space and let it soften in a way that rather than, you know, so maybe that part
mm-hmm.
changes, right? But it is really
yeah.
interesting to see.
But you know, absolutely right. We sit on the cushion and then we hold on to this and then we let it go. It didn't kill us. So that's our little mini, this is our petri dish, like I've said many times. That's our little mini experience. We hold on, we let it go. We let it go, we're still here. And then something else comes, we hold on to it, we let it go, we're still here. It doesn't kill us. It's like the monk who was hanging in, absolutely convinced that if she let go, that would be it. It's just not true. But our conditioning is so strong. And it's one of the reasons that Zen practice is so hard and has to be hard. It's why Sesshin exists. Because to touch the heart mind, we have to go through all of that conditioned delusion to touch what we truly and really are.
Again
and again and again. And it's painful, it's difficult, it's frustrating, it's frightening, and how else are we going to do it? Because the conditioning, or as Roshi used to say to us, ego is always checking. Always checking. Never shuts down. The 7-Eleven of the psyche. Always looking for a way in. Always looking to derail. Always looking to support itself. Always looking to make sure that nothing threatens its power in the world of the psyche. Checking, 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 he used to say.
Yeah, we'll turn loss into gain.
Say it again?
It will turn loss into
it
gain.
It will turn loss into gain. Exactly right. Why else would we withdraw at such a moment as when we're actually almost home? And we run in the opposite direction because ego is always checking. That one last part. It says, I'll take care of you. Yeah, very good. You did very good with that loss. It was terrific. I mean, your mother died. Your father died. You lost your dog. You lost your hair. You got fat. You're not cute. You know, whatever it is. Whatever it is. Right? You know? But this time, you can do it. And it's always a lie.
Yeah. And then you can beat yourself up for the fact that I'll hear my father's voice. Don't you ever learn?
Right.
You know, it's like I'm because I've done it before or been, you know, it's and I'm still doing it again, that I'm failing in a different way. So I can heap on even more.
Well, you know, we have to learn how to die. Again and again and again. And the thing that is amazing is that many people who are actually sort of have their death date like a birth date, you know, they're given a sort of terminal date or something like that, they finally learn how to live by learning how to die. Because you can't live unless you learn how to die. And that's one of the things that I think was so wonderful that Rushi was saying. If we can learn how to die, learn how to let go, learn how to release and therefore be released by all that fear and anxiety and frustration and, you know, hatred and aggression, you know, all the 11 heads on the crown of Kanseon, you know, of Kanon. We'll know how to be alive. And to be alive is to know the beauty and the joy and the wonder with no need to deny the pain. No need to squash anything. It's fine. How else can we understand why the Bodhisattva of compassion would have those heads as a crown? Fear, pain, suffering, hopelessness, despair, isolation, as the crown of compassion. One way of understanding is that unless we really allow these states and stop pushing them away, how deep can our compassion really be? Life is still too safe. Or seeming still too secure. So we die into dying. We die into hopelessness. We die into pain or despair, actively participating in all of that loss. And we discover something. It's okay. This life is great. And when it's time to go, we will. All that self-punishment of, oh, you should know by now, it's just stupid. It's just so stupid. You know. We're so fortunate, you know, to have this practice so that we can see through it and say, yeah, I'm stupid, but I'm a little less stupid than I was yesterday. That's a good thing. You know. And in case there's like a job opening for someone who's really stupid, we just raise our hand, show our resume. Wow, I've been stupid a long time. We get hired like that. You know, we can laugh at it because we can see it.
Can I say something?
Yeah, please.
Just, I think you said something yesterday to me about habits. And for me, it's a habit.
Absolutely.
And you know, I think you've done this practice long enough. You said 10 years. I think I've been 15, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. Like, I'm stupider than ever.
Yeah, but you know it.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. Yeah.
But, you know, part of it is, you know, when I feel it's going so fast, like my life's going too fast,
mm-hmm.
I think it's this very thing. It's because I'm trying to, you know,
absolutely
stop the river.
Yep. You're not going to stop the river.
So,
It's very powerful. It's very powerful to realize that we are the river. The stone is the river.
It really helps having an image like that.
Yeah.
Like that really helps.
Good.
A lot.
Good. I remember being in some national park in Utah, Zion National Park, oddly enough, looking at a stone in the middle of the river. And that's when I looked at it and I realized, yeah, that stone is not going to stop. The river is this big stone. The river just embraces it. You know, the river just puts its watery arms around the stone and says, you're dying. I'm taking you down. And it just flows on. And the stone says, oh, yeah. We do suffer, but we don't need to add to it. Knowing that it's a habit, which is just, you know, as Chris and I were talking about this yesterday. In other words, knowing that it's our conditioned self that creates these states is very important. And as I've said to you before, the good news is the same as the bad news. The bad news is that we're conditioned. The good news is that we're conditioned. That means we can change the condition. Thanks to impermanence, the very thing we're trying to stop. Yeah, just 1 second more, Jeff. It's really important to get this. Thanks to impermanence, we can change our suffering. As Roshi said, awareness vanishes delusion. And it can only happen thanks to the truth of impermanence. In Buddhist understanding, people may think it's great to be born as a deva or kind of demigod or something like that. But only human beings have the ability to work with impermanence through consciousness. This is in Buddhist teaching. It's because of human consciousness that we're able to transform delusion. The other guys just fly around and wherever they are. That's one way of understanding it. Yeah, Jeff?
I'm not quite sure how to ask this, but when you were talking about samadhi there, I'm thinking you're thinking of falling into that place as dying, and you mentioned fear pulling you out, which I've experienced a few times. I'm wondering what you do when that fear comes, but also in a way it makes the fear, isn't that, once the fear is there, it feels like I'm out, but I'm wondering, isn't that part of it as well? Isn't that just another face in samadhi? Like, how can it be pulled out? Maybe it's part of it, if that makes any sense. Is that samadhi as well, that deep, dark fear? Maybe samadhi is
in,
just as dark.
In that, see how I can talk about it. In that place that I'm talking about, all elements of separation are in the process of dissolving or have dissolved. So if fear is present to pull you out, that's something that came from the back that we didn't see and suddenly becomes present and pulls you away. There's still something separate. There's still something that hasn't completely become one with itself. So even in states like samadhi, that continues to exist from the back of the head where you can't see it. You know, that's why that stuff is moving back there. You can't see it. It still can exist. And if it's strong enough, it can pull you away, can pull you out. But if the practice, or as, you know, Roshi used to talk about it, because his father was a Chinese herbalist, and he was taught as a boy, If the poison doesn't taste bad, it's no good. The poison has to taste bad to cure you. So if the practice is strong enough, then you can withstand it in the same way that the Buddha withstood the assaults by Mara just before the Buddha's realization. So there's still some part that's separate, and it has to do with that. So to say, isn't it part of the samadhi? Well, it coexists at that time, but it hasn't yet reached that full I'm going to just say acceptance or surrender of its separate impulse. There's a separateness, a separate impulse, a separate inclination, you know, form, feeling, perception, inclination, discernment. This word inclination is very important. it means there's a certain tendency that still has energy in it to pull back. You know, we see it in like contemporary movies, you know, someone who, like romantic comedies, you know, someone he almost can let himself love her and then he runs away or something like that. You know? It's like that. It just still maintains its separateness because it feels safer there than to surrender completely. So, yeah, it's still in that, you're in that state and it still exists, but it's still separate from that state. When practice is strong enough, and this is to answer the other part of your question, when practice gets strong, and that means when your commitment to die, to let yourself go, your separated self is very, very strong, and you're willing to withstand all of the assaults in the same way that the Buddha did, then it won't pull you away. But you have to really be willing and practice learning that you will survive by dying over and over again is what makes that possible. It's what strengthens it. I've told you the story many times, but it's like 30 years ago during Sesshin, I went to Roshi and said, you know, this practice is just killing me. I don't think I can survive. And he just laughed. He said, you're supposed to die. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't think I can keep going. Mm-hmm. And he just said, go ahead, Peter, survive your life. And he just kicked me out of the Dokusan room. Just rang the bell and go ahead.
Just die, but keep on breathing.
Huh?
Just die, but keep on
breathing. Die, but keep on breathing. Go ahead, survive your life. I just was so mad. I don't know if that answers the question.
It does.
We have to recognize that's checking also in that moment. Pulling away.
Yeah.
It does have to do with the commitment. Say it again, Wendy. I can't see it. Oh! Okay, time for this talk to die.